I do think young people get a really rough ride at the moment. I do feel there's a lot of negativity around, you know, that they're not resilient, they're not robust, you know. And I can only say, by the young people I work with, that's just not the case. I think for a lot of them, they go through terrible things. And they absolutely do have resilience, but they just need additional support, I think, to get them, you know, on the track that's going to help them, you know, move forward. For some, it is important that they've got that clear label, because I think it makes sense to them. I think it's very scary for young people, I think, when they know there's something not right. They're not thinking maybe like some of their peers, but they don't understand it. I think that can be incredibly empowering, I think, for them, when it's like, gosh, actually, now I understand it. Now I know why I've been struggling.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfor. In this podcast, I will speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction and recovery. And I'll share my own story throughout these conversations. We are well and truly into season 5 of the show, and we're doing a mini series focused on youth and addiction. We speak to some really inspirational young people about how they personally have been affected by addiction and recovery, and some who have been surrounded by the addiction of others as a young person. We also speak with professionals who are working in the addiction and recovery youth sector. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Is Powerful. Many, many young people who struggled with mental health, disordered eating, or addiction have benefited from a guiding hand from our guest today. Over the past 35 years, Alex Blatch has worked in and managed a variety of private mental health settings, including inpatient, daycare, and outpatient services. Alex initially trained as a registered health nurse and later a bereavement counsellor. Alex speaks with humility and clarity about mental health conditions and has endless empathy and investment in the well-being and treatment of her clients. Hey, Alex, thank you for coming on. This Is Powerful. It's a pleasure to have you on here. So you have over 35 years of experience in mental health all across the board.
Yeah.
Why did you go into that arena?
Well, that's a good question. I'll be frank, I fell into it. It wasn't something I'd sort of planned. I suppose back in the day, I sort of thought about what sort of career I would like. Some of my family had been in nursing. And it was actually through a friend of my mum's. Their daughter had come down and started psychiatric nursing. And my mum said to me, is that something you consider? And I thought, well, actually, you know, I've nothing else to go to. So I came for an interview down in Epsom and Surrey. And the rest is history. I got taken on and wow. Loved it. Yeah, wow. I really loved it. Because I wasn't great at school.
Yeah.
Academically, I struggled quite a lot at school, I think. And I was looking for something that I felt I was good at.
Because it's a real... To be in that space, you have to be, a real human being.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Be really present, yeah. Don't you? Yeah. And aware of yeah. yourself
yeah.
and connected yeah. to other
yeah.
people.
Very much so. And I mean, something I reflect on, because I think as a youngster, I think I was very much agony aunt with friends. I think it was a role I fell into very easily. I think I was often the person my friends would come to. And I think for my self-esteem, I recognised that was probably something I was starting to feel good about. People needed me. It's how I got my value. So in a way, I think landing into psychiatric nursing in particular, because there's a lot around, obviously listening to people and, yeah, trying to see their perspective, as you say, be real with people, that felt very natural for me.
It's quite a strong personality to have, because you have to have empathy, which can be difficult because you can feel other people's pain.
Yeah.
But also the power to listen.
Yeah.
Not many people listen.
Mm.
Because if you come to someone with a problem, they're like, oh, you'll get over it. Oh, it's okay. And they can brush it off. So it's quite a thing, actually, to have a natural talent,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Did you expect it to be different in what you've experienced?
That's a really good question. I don't think I've ever been asked that. I hadn't planned to do it. I don't think I had preconceived ideas. I think there's been aspects... I feel I've managed it maybe better than I thought. I think I wasn't sure that I would do it for a long time. And I think the people that I've worked with have been great. I think that's something, again, I hadn't really considered. Mm. I didn't know how my colleagues would be or how people would find me. That's been really good. I mean, that's probably one of the reasons I've stayed as long as I have, because I really enjoy the people I work with.
It's probably a reflection on yourself as well.
Hopefully. I mean, gosh, you can see so immediately. I'm really uncomfortable.
It's not what I heard. No.
I'm so, I find that, that's the bit you're probably gathering already. I find that really uncomfortable. Mm. But that's sort of thrown me a bit, because it's not something I've really ever been asked before. I think I'm also somebody I try not to think too hard about how something's going to be, because I think I can very quickly consider myself, actually, I'm not going to do well in this. So I think I just thought, oh, let's just do it, just try it and see how you go. Hadn't really planned it. It's been great for me, if I'm honest. I've got a lot from it.
Well, your reputation exceeds you, even though you don't like compliments.
Yeah. No.
Where are you from originally?
So Liverpool originally. Oh, okay. Yeah. Was there for 19 years. Yeah, moved down to London to do my nurse training when I was 19.
How was Liverpool for you?
Various aspects. I mean, I'm in the humour. I know it's cliche. Humour was great. You know, school was okay. I think I struggled, just mum and I. I thought it was quite difficult growing up in the 70s with a single parent. And I think there was, you know, I was there with the riots. There was a lot of violence going on in the early 80s. But there's a real soul, I feel, to Liverpool. There are aspects that I really liked, but I also knew probably in my early teens it wasn't somewhere I was going to stay. Didn't know quite where I was going to be. I mean, I thought about maybe going abroad. But I knew it wasn't somewhere I was going to be there long term.
Do you think that's because you felt like there was more to life than what you'd experienced?
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we had a very humble sort of life, you know. We went on the poverty line, but things were basic, and I wanted more than that. That was something I was very driven about.
In the 70s, everything was basic.
So bad. No jobs either, when you look gosh, I mean, you look back at the decor.
Kind of reflecting where we're getting now. This is like round two.
Absolutely.
Why did you struggle with education, if you don't mind me asking?
A lack of confidence, I think. I mean, generally in my life, I've lacked confidence. I had a lot of criticism from my, I'm going to be very open here, I had a lot of criticism from my grandfather. Growing up, we lived, because mum was a single parent, we lived with my grandparents for the first 10 years of my life. And he was old school, had a high expectation. I think he struggled with the fact that, you know, obviously I was, you know, didn't have a dad around. Yeah. And that was, for him, I think he found that quite shaming on the family. So I think that was something he, in his own way, I think that was something he sort of projected onto me at times.
Very, very old Victorian mentality.
Very. You know, and that was obviously tough on mum as well. Mum was desperate to be in her own place. And, you know, she was on the housing list. We eventually got our own place when I was 10. And that changed things a lot for us. But I think in a way that had already been set. I think my belief was that, you know, I wasn't good enough. Mm. And I think for me in school, I just don't think I tried very
hard.
When you
have an older person around you that's saying things that affect you in that way, that would knock your confidence easy before you're 10. And then you believe that, because that's all you know, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. And really for me, he was my, you know, he was my father figure as well. He was any sort of male figure I knew, you know, growing up. So he was really important to me. I guess his views really, really mattered. And in a way, I think that's what happened for me when I started my nursing. It was like, gosh, actually, there is something I can do. Mm. That's, I think, what probably why it bit. And it was suddenly like, actually, you know, I'm good at something. I think for the first time in my life.
You find validation, don't you?
Yeah, then? Very much so. Yeah.
That's amazing. So where did you move through the mental health space to where you are now at Lions Campus?
So let me think. So when I qualified at the end of the late 80s, believe it or not, very few jobs at the time, actually, very few jobs. It was just one of those times, a lot of unemployment. So I'd applied for various nursing roles and got interviewed at the Priory. So I was lucky.
You?
Yeah. So that was my first job.
What one?
Roehampton. Yeah.
Oh, so that's the big fancy one.
It's the big fancy one. Yeah. Flagship. Nice. I remember my interview very well. I was late. So the taxi that I'd booked hadn't turned up. So great start. But they were wonderful. I have to say, they were really good. The people that interviewed me. So yeah, I started on a ward for about 3 years. And then they were opening up a day hospital there. So I applied for the job and was very lucky enough to get it. And then I think for me, that's when I realised actually I enjoyed the nursing, but I wanted to do more counselling and therapy. I recognised that was the area I was more interested in than doing the nursing.
What's the, for those who don't know, when you was working on the ward, what does nursing mean? What do you do?
Yeah, so I guess it's lots of aspects really. Partly, I mean, a lot of it's that support and care, you know, so it's the, you know, for me, it was the friendly face when you're on duty, you know, a lot of reassurance, you know, people come in, a lot of people very anxious, understandably, of, you know, they don't understand what's happening to them, a very unfamiliar surroundings, you know, people, especially back then, you know, had, you know, lots of negative views of what a psychiatric hospital would be like, you know, a very frightening, sort of maybe a violent place. So for me, it was a lot about, you know, giving that, those patients reassuring humor. I use humor a lot. I mean, that's
so important.
Yeah, it's so important. I found, and you really connect with people. Yeah, and I think it's, you know, you do all the classics, you do the medication rounds, you'd, you know, do regular checks in, you'd make sure, you know, they go to their therapy, you'd make sure they keep their any physical appointments. So it's a lot of, I suppose, you know, befriending, guiding, and supporting. I think they were the key things with nursing.
People don't know this about the Priory Group, right? Because they've only seen, I assume, famous people going in and out and think it's an addiction program, but it's not, is it? It's actually a mental
hospital. It is. And in fact, you know, I mean, I've not been there for about 5 years now, but I think it's fair to say the addiction is a very small component of Priory as a whole. I mean, it's even, you know, that when I was at Roehampton, I mean, we had, you know, we didn't have CAMHS enough back then, but we had eating disorder clients, you know, people with just general mental health issues, and then the addiction service was always there, but it was probably a, you know, small percentage of the client group overall. Yeah,
because I went to the North London Priory.
Oh, I was there a few years later.
Was you?
Yeah, yeah.
I wish you was there when I was there. We had a nurse that wasn't great. I took swimming trunks and gym gear because I thought I was going to this fabulous hotel where I could just rest.
Love it.
And and didn't have to do anything.
Yeah.
And when I had my interview there, they're like, no, you have what's called cross addiction. And I was like, I have no idea what that is.
Yeah.
And we suggest you stay in and we'll have one of the patients talk to you. So I had some guy who actually I'm still talking to, David.
Fantastic, yeah.
Come out and tell me about it. And I was so confused. I'm like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, and checking in. Yeah. I was like, I just had no idea.
Quite a shock as well. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But it was good. It was actually really brilliant for me personally.
Yeah. And I'd just like to say that I think that was something probably over the years, something that was important to me. I think there was a sense, especially working with someone like Pry, was the as you say, it was just the rich and famous. And I found that to struggle sometimes because actually behind the doors, there was just so much going on for people. You know, you'll know this. It was life-changing for some people. It was, you know, often people at their worst, you know, in the most disordered state. And, you know, I suppose for me, it came across as a bit flippant sometimes when it was suggested that it's, you know, a place just for the rich and famous. Oh, and well, actually, it's just not what it's about at all.
No, not at all. And that's everyone behind the doors equal.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was in there with some people that are very well known.
Yeah.
And no one cared because it was about, are we getting better?
Yeah, yeah.
Can we, you know, help each other and work as a team in peer groups and stuff like that? And I found it such a profound experience. I was lucky, I think, with the group I was in, to be honest.
Makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Because a couple of people didn't want help initially that really caused disruption.
Yeah.
When they left, everyone did.
Yeah.
And it was and most of us are still around, which is pretty cool.
It's important to keep in touch, really.
So when you went from nursing to addiction, did you have to train differently? And was that for all ages?
Yeah, so the next thing I did, so I'd done my basic nurse training for 3 years and I decided actually what I now need to do is look at counselling and therapy. Yeah. So probably spent the next sort of, 4 or 5 years doing various therapies. So I did a basic counselling training, which covered all areas again. Mm. Addiction was quite key. But then the area I found I was interested in, a lot of people doing it was bereavement. I think we'd had, you know, some clients and patients, you know, in the hospitals that were really struggling with you know, losing various people. And I thought, actually, that would be a bit more of a niche for me. And I really, I found that very profound of honesty. It was difficult because you had people that came and volunteered to be counselled by us as new trainees. And I learned a lot from them. And the grief that they were going through was awful. But I think it helped ground me even further. I think it humbled me a lot. I think how people were coping with some just awful situations. And again, there were people who, yeah, they had their own addiction, you know, and then they had these awful situations where they'd lost people very close to them. So it helped for me maybe combine everything in a way. I think it enabled me to draw on all those skills from my nursing, then my basic counselling, yeah. then specifically with the bereavement as well.
This may sound like a silly question, but what actually is bereavement? Because I've lost many friends now, yeah, being in, yeah. in, at my age and being in recovery, and I've been affected in different ways yeah. by different
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
And my first experience was my grandma when she died. I think I was seven, and I have the weirdest thing that I used to see her every Saturday and stay there for like Saturday night
yeah.
for 7 years of my life.
Wow.
And I can't remember hardly any of it. So I think right. I was traumatized yeah, by it when
yeah,
I was told.
Yeah.
And with my grandfather, who I was very close to, when I saw him, I was 19, when I saw him in a coffin, I just laughed because I had so much nerves, but I was so devastated. Yeah. I just, my body was just doing its own yeah. thing. And that took me a long time to get over that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've had different experiences. What generally is bereavement to someone?
So the way I would explain it, I guess, is it's really, I suppose it's how somebody experiences death with somebody usually close to them. So I guess it's everything, isn't it? It's definitely a mental sort of challenge for some. Mm. You know, I think there's, because exactly as you're describing, I think that people close to us, they represent so much to us, I think, especially when we're young. So I think it's partly trying to, in your mind, I guess, trying to make sense of what's happened and why that person isn't there anymore. It's definitely physical change. I mean, that's the bit I learned a lot in my training, is that there's a lot of physical differences. I mean, it's very powerful. I think people often will talk, you know, when I was counselling people with bereavement, people would talk more where they felt the sensation physically more than connecting emotionally. Yeah. And that helped me in a way just to tap in more, I guess, with what was really going on for that person. And then, as you described, Paul, definitely the trauma. I think people found it incredibly yeah. traumatic. And what I'd add to that, I think it's a lot around, I mean, I think culture is fascinating with bereavement. So yeah. I think we're, you know, in especially I think in the UK, I think it's got better, but I think we were often very private in our bereavement, weren't we? Mm. I think people often felt that you've just got to, you know, get on with the things. This terrible thing's happened, but really you've just got to move on, pick up the day, you know, carry on as you've always done. Other cultures, I think there's something to be said for, you know, that lots of wailing.
Celebrating
and yeah, I think it's incredible, you know, rather than that stern, I've got to hold things together. And if you don't, I'd like to show you, just ask me about the bereavement. There was somebody I worked with actually at one of the priories, and it was a terrible tragedy. They lost their husband. They were working in addiction. And I remember at the funeral, quite a few of his staff went and joined. And I was really touched by her. I mean, she was very openly emotional. I mean, it was heartbreaking listening to it, but I think it was very powerful.
Yeah.
And I walked away thinking, gosh, actually, because for part of me, I'm a very private person. And I thought, wow, that's incredible. This person can just show that level of emotion and not worry about it. And I think it was really cathartic for everybody there.
There's a freedom in that and an honesty,
a lot,
isn't there?
An awful lot, actually. As you say, I think for a lot as well, growing up, I think it's, a lot of us aren't good at talking about death.
My dad's so old, Victorian.
Really?
Used to be, for the last 15 years of his career, he used to be a funeral director.
Oh, wow, gosh.
And I'd go there to see him, and he'd just be eating his sandwiches next to somebody and just talking. He's a particular type of person, because he stayed there one night and stayed in a coffin and slept in the room all night to make his friend jump in the morning. I could never do that.
Just about the thought of being next to it, yeah.
Well, yeah, just in case he's like spirits or something, I'd be like, no, not for me. He's like, there's no such thing, it's totally fine. Yeah. And then generally slept in there, was totally fine. That for me is just not. But he's not really emotional. I've only seen him be emotional once. With his mother. I think it's different for everyone, isn't it?
It is, it really is. And I think, so, you know, generationally, I mean, that has a big impact, you say. I mean, culturally, definitely. And I think, and I guess the key thing, isn't it, is that the relationship you had with that person. I mean, you're describing your grandmother, who clearly, you know, given you were there every Saturday, for me, she must have been a really, you know, sort of key person for those first few years. Yeah,
completely.
You know, this, we can have other people, might be a family member that we've known a long time, but we haven't got a particularly close relationship, though. So the impact is not quite the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very personal, isn't it?
It is. It really is, yeah.
When did you move on to helping young people?
So that came about probably when, I think when I moved to Chelmsford Priory, that was back in the sort of late 90s, because we happened to have a, there was a CAMHS ward there. I'd not really, I'd seen some young people when I was at Priory Hampton, but we hadn't had a specific CAMHS service there.
Can I just jump in?
Yeah.
What's a CAMHS service?
So it's a child and mental health services. So it's, right. Yeah, it's a funny sort of word, but it just encompasses, I guess, you know, community services, inpatient services.
Right.
And it's a term used for young people who have mental health needs. And it's just shortened to CAMHS.
Yeah.
And I won't lie, that was quite a contrast for me, because I'd by that point, what I'd been probably 7 or 8 years used to working with adults, and it's a very different thing working with young people. Mm. And I was very nervous, I won't lie. It was, I think I fell back into, would I be good enough? Would I be able to connect with young people? And actually, it was amazing. You know, I think I find young people fascinating, but I think they're, in the main, they're very robust. I think they're able to manage a lot of difficulty in their life and often, you know, be very brutally honest, but I think it's a good thing. Often I found adults are not so good. They've built good defences.
They've learned to hide, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I that was a breath of fresh air for me, actually. I mean, you know, working with young people who, and they'd tell you if they didn't like you, they would tell you. Whereas, again, adults are not good at doing that.
No.
There was the other side to it as well, where you would see young people coming in very unwell, though, and that could be hard, you know, very... You know, they had psychosis, for example, so where they have a sense that they're not really attached to the real world. You know, they've gone into a world that, you know, for others outside, they can't really understand. Mm. And you know, they're very distressed. That's hard, where you can see people, you know, they're hurting themselves, or they look terrified, or they're shut down. That was probably the hard part. And I know teams that I were working with found that very hard as well.
Is that drug-induced psychosis?
It can be, and some of it, sadly, is just, unfortunately, the way their brain is wired.
Yeah,
there was quite a lot of young people, even back then, that were, experimenting with drugs, and there was certainly psychosis had been brought on because of the amount of medication, or sadly, there's just somebody who just doesn't manage well with drugs, and it had that impact. That was hard.
Is there a length of psychosis? Like, can you have a short-term psychosis?
Yeah.
And can you have a long-term
psychosis? You can, absolutely, yes. Yeah, definitely you can. And I think, probably for me, I would say it's how quickly you can get help. So, I think for most parents, they would recognise their child being very different. You know, if they're suddenly appearing to be very withdrawn, maybe talking to somebody that clearly isn't there, or responding to maybe, you know, voices that you're thinking, hang on, this just isn't my child anymore. Usually people will reach out, parent would reach out hopefully quite quickly, even if it's to their GP. So, you know, for me, I think part of it is if you can seek help with your child quite early on, I think, you know, I'm going to be honest, I think medication is a big factor. I think they get seen, get assessed and get the right medication and then support. That doesn't have to last very long at all. I think it's probably more where somebody has a, you know, it's not drug induced. It's to do with the way you say their brain is wired. I'm being simplistic, I know.
Yeah.
I think that can be longer term, but can be managed. Again, it can be managed very well. You know, we have some really good early intervention psychosis, you know, teams now in the NHS that can really offer help for people in that position.
And do you think that there's more psychosis cases now than when you started work?
I would say so, actually. Yes, I think part of it is, I think there's better diagnosis and awareness, but I think there's also a lot more of drug experimentation. I mean, we know this. Mm. Drugs are much more readily available. Often they're cheaper than alcohol. I mean, you know, if you'd asked me 30 years ago, I found that incomprehensible. Really, you know,
it's crazy.
It's terrifying,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's really crazy. I lived in New York for many years,
yeah.
And in New York, there's a funny thing. When I first went to LA. I said to my friend, I was like, I'm sure someone's smoking like skunk.
Yeah.
And he went, no, there is a skunk in the garden. And I was like, no, it's not. And there was a skunk in the garden. It's the same smell. So I realised why they call it skunk.
Yeah, yeah.
But in New York, often in apartment blocks, you could smell it a lot.
Yeah.
And I never smelt it in London. Now when I go on the tube, nine times out of 10, I can smell strong skunk. Yeah. Either someone's transporting it or they've got their thing in their pocket. Yeah. And I find that quite disturbing.
Yeah, I agree. And it's literally everywhere, isn't it? I mean, that's the worrying part. And that's, I don't know, I think it's, for me, I think that's really tough for young people to navigate because it's just so readily available everywhere.
And peer pressure. And we want to belong as humans. And there's a lot of peer pressure to belong. But I feel from the stuff I've seen, that you're really rolling the dice now. And that old thing about, sentence about, oh, it's organic, it's grown on, it's a plant, it's fine, is that train's left so long ago.
It is scary. I mean, see, you know, this with the vapes, that's something that we've, where I am at the moment, that's something that the young people have been talking about a lot, where, you know, there's some of them have, you know, got things that have no idea what's in there, and it's terrifying.
When someone goes on medication for a young person, how fast does that turn around? And do you, I'm asking basic questions for the audience, do you have to have therapy specifically for psychosis when you're on meds? And if you didn't, what's the difference?
Yeah. So usually what I mean, if I'm talking to a parent, for example, and because it's a question I think they'll often ask and say, okay, you know, if my child starts medication, when would we maybe start to see some change? Usually what we'd say is, you know, you're probably looking at, you know, I'd say a week to 10 days to really start to see a change, probably just a more calmer presentation, usually better sleep. You know, it's a big change. We know this is one of the things that makes the psychosis worse if they're sleeping poorly. You know, we know this, you know, having deprivation of sleep is awful for most of us. So I'd usually say to parents, look, it's not an overnight change. You do have to be patient. So I think it's just encouraging to say, look, it will happen. Just work with your child to encourage them to take medication.
Pretty quick though. Does it change that quick?
Yeah. I mean, you certainly would start to see things, anxiety levels dissipating, as I say, improve sleep, generally just being calmer.
Yeah.
The therapy point is an interesting one. I mean, certainly we know, thankfully these days, with talking therapies, your GP would certainly advise, but in most parts, if it's a mild to moderate presentation, that what they would say is probably talking therapies is the best intervention at that point. When you start to get moderate to severe, that's when they will say, look, the medication is probably the key aspect to start with, and then combined with the talking therapy would give you the best outcome. Yeah.
And does when someone's either seeing someone or hearing voices, does the medication just suppress your emotions, or does that change that thought process? Would that voices stop?
Yeah, it's the latter. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I think it's, you know, I think it's, I think it's just an aspect of, I guess that in that moment, I think this is the difficulty. They start to, you know, for some they have auditory hallucinations or they have voices. I mean, it's an interesting question because I often will do the initial assessment with young people, and it's a standard question. I will want to check in with them if they ever, you know, heard voices. And if they do say yes, you're trying to understand, is it a voice they recognise? What I'm trying to gather is it their own voice?
Yeah.
Because we all know we self-esteem, our internal critic, you know.
Yeah, I've got a really good one.
Yeah, I think
he's wrote Encyclopedia is my one.
And this is the, you know, so I think it's, hopefully for most young people, they realise actually on talking to other people, that's probably what it is. It's their own internal voice really giving them a hard time. It's when they start to say, actually, it's outside of my head.
Right.
It's not somebody I recognise. Oh, yes, it's somebody I recognise, but it's not me. That's when you know, there's a few other things you'd want to ascertain, but that's when you're thinking, okay, this could be psychosis. And what I do is I would advise anybody, because ultimately I'm even though I've got many years of experience, I'm not in a position to diagnose. So that's where, in a situation like that, that's where I'd be encouraging the young person and their family to consider maybe seeing a psychiatrist, because they're going to be best placed to determine really what is the presenting issue.
Yeah.
But terrifying for the young person, you know.
It's interesting because we are the only mammal that can watch our own thinking and hear it. But I guess if you don't have any education or anything around that, it could be quite disturbing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, within maybe your peer group or your family, that's just something you never talk about. And why, in a way, why would you?
No.
It does seem a bit of a strange thing to start chatting about. Yeah, and, you know, I think it would be frightening. I think
it's kind of common in meditation circles or recovery circles.
Good
like
point. Yeah.
Someone will say, oh, I thought about doing this today, but then I told myself that's a silly thing to do. So you kind of grasp your thinking, don't you? Which is really empowering. But there is a stage, I remember when I first come in, that I could really hear my thoughts and I could really hear like, oh, don't do this or don't do that. And that was scary for a while. Then I realised it was just me.
Yeah, yeah. But it is, and I think, I don't know about you, I think, I mean, I remember as a teenager very strongly. I think it's a developmental part, isn't it? I think it's, you know, part of growing up, part of knowing who we are. You know, I think that's, for me, when the voices can be particularly strong. And again, you know, bring it all, looping it back, you know, when we have trauma in our life, these things can become stronger, you know. Our inner voice, as we class it, would be a lot stronger often,
Hi, it's Paul here. I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you and to say if you've heard something on the show that's moved you, please follow, rate or review the show, and it'd be amazing if you could share it. Now back to the show. Do you think, you said something really important about the awareness, but there seems to be at the moment in young people lots of ADHD or problems.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's just because it's more in the media. In your experience, is there more problems or what do you think is going on?
Personally, I would say I think it's complex and I think it's multifaceted. I think there is clearly better diagnosis. So I think there's, no, let me take a step back. I think there's improved recognition. I think first part. I think people are recognizing it more, and I think then by the recognition, people think, okay, is this more than just a few issues? You know, maybe there's a mild learning difficulty. Is it more severe than that? And I think because of that, people are seeking it help and advice. And I think there's definitely, you know, an increased ability to diagnose. So I think there's just a broader training. I think there's more psychiatrists, therefore, that are able to diagnose. So I think that's one factor. I suppose I also reflect back, you know, it's hard to think, well, okay, when I was younger, you know, because we would have called it something different, which I can't say on this, but, you know, there would have been very, very negative, you know, this. I mean, you know, you would have said people are, you know, thick or stupid.
Well,
or,
that's what happened to me,
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
And I'm dyslexic, and I was just told, your concentration's rubbish, you can't be bothered, but you can't. Yeah. And it was difficult, and I was just called, I wasn't called stupid directly from the teachers, but some of my peers called me that.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, because I couldn't focus on something I didn't really want to to learn.
And so I think for me, it's clearly always been there, hasn't it? But we just called it something different back then.
You got
then.
Dismissed, didn't you, basically?
Yeah, very much so. And it was just, you know, tough tip. Basically, you're back at the end of the queue and you'll you know, you just have to get on with it. So I do think that's a good thing. I think the negative aspect, can't it be, is that what happens is sometimes we feel there needs to be a label. Mm. And so that's the cautious bit, I would say. It's about saying, okay, it's not always ADHD. It's not always a specific learning disability. I think it's important to explore it and determine if there is something there that could be a benefit.
There's something about building resilience.
Yeah.
I don't think it's right. There's a medium here because I think you can, I personally, if you have something which is slightly different, then people think, oh, is it, there's a problem, there's a label, like you said. Yeah. And then you don't get to be resilient or recognise yourself in certain ways. Yeah. So we try and do it with our kids and talk through stuff. But there's a push in the media, I think, at the moment for that. And I was like, is that pharmaceutical companies just wanting to medicate people? Because I lived in America and that seemed to be what was happening.
Yeah, yeah. And I know so many people say it now, but I do think young people get a really rough ride at the moment. I do feel there's a lot of negativity around, you know, that they're not resilient, they're not robust, you know, they need support with everything. And I can only say, by the young people I work with, that's just not the case. I think for a lot of them, they go through terrible things, and they absolutely do have resilience, but they just need additional support, I think, to get them, you know, on the track that's going to help them, you know, move forward. And I think for some, it is important that they've got that clear label, because I think it makes sense to them. I think it's very scary for young people. I think when they know there's something not right, they're not thinking maybe like some of their peers, but they don't understand it. I think that can be incredibly empowering, I think, for them. And it's like, gosh, actually, now I understand it. Now I know why I've been struggling.
I agree. I actually got diagnosed when I was 40 about dyslexia.
Right.
I knew something was wrong.
Yeah.
Had uncontrollable anxiety when I was reading anything.
Yeah.
Or if someone said, oh, do you mind reading that? I'd clam up and start, and I was 40. I'm like, why do I do that? So it was good for me, but there wasn't really an answer.
No, whereas hopefully now, there's more help and definitely more people who are trained and can help specifically with those sort of issues, yeah.
What's affecting, is there a difference between female and male at the moment of what's affecting them? For example, is there more eating disorders with young ladies than there are with guys?
I think generally, I think percentage-wise, there always is a high ratio of I'd say, female young women with an eating disorder. But we definitely know over the last few years, we've seen an increase with men as well. And I think, again, media pressure, body image. I think there's a lot of pressure on young boys to be good at everything. I think, be able to do lots of sports, be intelligent, get the best woman. In the school,
it's everything.
It's a hell of a pressure for them. Yeah.
And do you think that is just social media, like over a period of time, where that becomes a narrative between young people?
I think it's part of like that, but I also think, I mean, certainly for our culture, I think the differences between men and men has changed a lot. I think the expectation on men is hard. I think trying to navigate really what is their role in society is really tough at the moment. I mean, I'm probably speaking because I've got a son and a daughter, and I often think about this. The difference between the two and the pressures on men, I think generally is at its highest right now. I think trying to find their role, particularly in a partnership, and expectations on them of how they should be able to manage everything and be the best at everything, I think is really tough. So I think for me, that's why I think there's more, I think there's probably a bit more increase in body dysmorphia with men as well. I think they're thinking a lot more around image. I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily. I think it's good that men to look after themselves.
Men bath more than they used to and stuff like that. Yeah, being in locker rooms used to be pretty awful.
Pretty horrendous, yeah.
We were talking briefly before, being in the fashion industry and having lots of male friends in there, I noticed that eating disorders or like a fitness disorder where you have to train, you have to get to a certain body fat, that the people that had that were rewarded by, on the outside, it looked like you got amazing discipline.
Yeah.
You know, you go to the gym twice a day. You do an hour cardio, you punch the bag, you do weights. Like, it's incredible what this person does. But behind the scenes, you could see it was a desperate measure to control stuff. Yeah. So actually, it wasn't a healthy thing. But on the outside, guys kind of looked at it and applauded it.
Yeah. And can I ask this? So in the fashion industry, time you were very much immersed in it, on the male models, was there the same pressure to be a certain size?
Because we know 100%.
So is that
completely. And I'll tell you my own experiences. For example, I went to an event last night and they said, oh, would you mind trying a jacket on? And I'm quite broad, so I'm a 44 chest. When I started, that was the maximum you could be, and it was quite healthy.
Wow.
And then people went down to, in the last few years, like a 38 chest.
Wow.
I wasn't like that when I was 15.
I mean, that's small.
It's tiny,
isn't it?
I started to work, so I feel next to a young model as if I'm obese, like I'm too big. And that's a feeling I'll actually still have.
Yeah.
Even though I know that I'm a 55-year-old man, I still train, I'm healthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'll still feel less than because of that narrative.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I've always had like a big back, but I would hear like in Italy, be like, oh, grosso, like the back's too big and stuff. But that's my natural frame.
Yeah.
So, yes, there is completely. Like now, you always, it's really about the a visual amount of body fat you have for guys. So you could be skinny but still be loose skinned and not toned, or you could be big and be really ripped. But it's about that. It's just about the definition, really. And then when metrosexuality come along, it was about having no shoulders and just being straight down.
Right, because I suppose I remember the V-shape. That was the image I recall.
100%. And when I started, that's what it was like. And then that changed.
Yeah.
And I remember I was just under a 28-inch waist when I started, and I think it was like a 41 chest.
Yeah.
And I moved to Milan with a couple of really fun Italian-Americans from Brooklyn, like, hey, Polly, let's do some soup. And anyway, they do like these sauces and soups and then pasta. And basically, we just get so much carbs. that I put on two sizes.
Yeah.
You wouldn't really notice. And then when I went back to work for a company in London, they was like, oh. And they put a measuring tape around me like, oh, you've gone up a couple of sizes. Yeah. As if it, and I was still like a 30, but it was like a bad thing.
Which I would say still is still small. I mean, 28-inch waist for a guy is small. Gosh,
tiny.
Yeah.
It's tiny.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Yeah. No, there's completely that. And there's a real... there's a real unsaid street about it. So there's so much political correctness now about things, but people still have such a bias on size in fashion.
Yeah.
I mean, they really do. And and it's quite cutting and they don't realize. So I have an agent, for example, in Paris. I'll go there and he's like, oh, you look great. And he'll just pinch you at the side. Go, oh, maybe a bit more gym now. It's just subtle things that have so much power. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's definitely that still there.
So image generally, isn't it? I think is much more in the spotlight. I mean, of course, it's always been around, but I just feel that whole pressure again on young people, isn't it, to look and you know be a certain way. I think is far harder now than it was. You know, certainly when I was growing up.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more. I mean, now there's a whole market, isn't there, for guys, deodorants, creams, and stuff, But with that, I would say as a man that, you know, I bought into that for a long time. And it's such a dangerous way to measure your health if you're not into that business.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a basketball player, you should be super tall.
Yeah.
And if you're a model, you need to be a certain size. But generally for people, it's such a vacuous thing. To lean on, because you'll never be good enough for yourself.
It
will make you completely ill, because you'll be totally thinking about how you sit, how you move, what you do, and it would just bury you in the ground. And I now look at, like, it's good to be fit for longevity.
Yes.
And I'll train.
Yeah.
I'll train as I used to anyway, but I'm doing it for different purposes, and it's completely different.
Yeah. So your focus, which is a positive, you know, your health and well-being. Going forward, absolutely right,
which is good.
Yeah.
And what about the girls? Because I know in my business that, I've shared this before, I worked with a girl in Turkey who, she came on the job, and I know she had quite a big name, and when she came on the job, she looked terrible.
Oh, gosh.
We started to speak, and basically her Italian agency had said to her, you know, you need to lose weight quickly, so just eat apples, drink black coffee and water and smoke.
Yeah.
And that's what this girl did for 3 weeks. She looked like death warmed up.
Gosh,
I've seen her lately, and she's clearly now eating well.
Right.
And looks amazing. Yeah.
It's the complexion, isn't it? Often is the telltale as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, working with eating disorders has just happened to be something I think pretty much I think all of my 35 years that there's always been either a ward or an outpatient service it's been eating disorders that I've worked with. And so I think it's quite shocking actually just what people can live on. That's the other bit. I mean, for you to say, you know, almost being encouraged to just have, you know, a piece of fruit and a black coffee and a cigarette, you can't imagine that you're advising somebody to live in that. Of course, that's nowhere near what we need to be eating just to survive. And I think it's very competitive. And the other bit I think that's changed in my time is people being able to access, you know, websites that will tell you how to lose weight, you know, how to be anorectic. And that's shocking for me. I mean, you know, there's, you know, no way when I was first, you know, out there in nursing, you know, you would never have comprehended that would be something people would think to do. Because, again, it goes against everything that we'd been taught about being compassionate and kind and caring. So why the hell would somebody want to encourage somebody else to do this terrible thing?
Dark.
But it is. And a lot of pressure, and a lot of our young girls that we see, that they've read them, they've seen them, they've watched them, and they're tempted.
For the audience and for young people, this is a broad question, but what is an eating disorder? Because generally you hear about bulimia and anorexia, but it's very complex, isn't it?
It is.
What is an individual trying to achieve initially?
So I think if I could broaden it as well, I think these days we tend to call it more disordered eating because there's so many aspects now, I think, of where we know people are struggling with various issues. You know, so you've got situation, you know, the real extreme, somebody who has anorexia nervosa, where they are totally restricting all aspects of food and sometimes drink, and over-exercising or using laxatives. And I think to define, you know, anorexia would be that they've, you know, they've lost a lot of weight, you know, so they're, what we call their body mass index is extremely low. You know, you're talking probably less than sort of 15 as a standard body mass index. That's very low, just to put in context. You know, sort of you want somebody really to be around about a 20 body mass index. So it's a big drop down. And I think for some young people, trying to sustain that low weight, it becomes obsessive. So I think that's the other part. You often find people are obsessively thinking about food 24/7 and thinking of ways of just keeping low weight. I think when you're meeting a person for the first time, you're trying to understand, is it anorexia they have? They're the questions you'd be trying to understand. What's your intake on a daily basis? Mm. Are you exercising? Are you using any form of laxatives? How do you feel generally about your body? Those are the sort of things that you'd find out. And usually if they're yes to lots of those questions, you know this is definitely somebody with anorexia. You've then got the bulimia, where people, tend to binge eat. What you'll find is that the sort of weight tends to stabilise, because what they're doing is they're getting some of that fuel in. So they don't often have a big drop in weight, but what they do is that they're usually, you know, they're purging, they're vomiting on a regular basis. They're usually over-exercising again and definitely would use laxative. But because they're at least intaking the food, some of that will, the nutrients and the carbs will go in. So they're not losing the weight like you would see with somebody with anorexia. Mm. And then you've got, you know, people who have lots of issues around texture of food. So we see this a lot more now where young people are averse to eating certain foods. And this is where we'd class that the disordered eating, where they're struggling a lot with, just texture or taste or colour, and they will avoid lots of foods. And we know now that what's happened, people who might have been diagnosed with anorexia in the past, it was more disordered eating.
Because it was like a phobia?
It's just an avoidance. So it could be started when they're very, very young. You know, there's certain foods they just would totally avoid. Or you have people who, you know, I know we've had, I mean, talking very young people, somewhere I used to work, we would see people from the age of 12. And we had some young people, literally, chips was pretty much all that they would have in their diet.
Wow.
And it was just to do with, you know, their association with certain foods. They just couldn't bear the thought of eating them. And then what you do is slowly introduce other food types, other textures. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And I know, you know, from years gone by, we probably had people on our wards where we thought it was anorexia and it probably was, and they call it ARFID, but it was probably more to do with disordered eating and a fear of foods. It wasn't that they looked in the mirror and saw themselves fat when they're thin. That wasn't the issue, but I think that was a misunderstanding back then.
What is that brought on by a trauma? What brings that on?
Often it can be. I mean, interesting enough as well, it can be associated with maybe with Asperger's. So again, it's the some people with a learning disability or ADHD or Asperger's. We know sensory aspects are very high with people with this sort of presenting with this sort of issue, and of course, so food can come into that a lot because we know there's lots of sensory aspects to eating and taste and smell. I think again, it's probably we're just seeing more of it because we're diagnosing more people and recognizing it more.
When you said about purging food and vomiting, someone could say, oh, well, it's okay because I'm maintaining weight.
Yes.
What are the effects? Because the acid in your throat and teeth can't be great.
Yeah.
There must be other downsides. Yeah. What's the downside?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you end up, I mean, so some people, as you rightly say, I mean, you end up with people with, sadly, with rotting teeth because, you know, the acidity, it's obviously can affect the lining of your esophagus, but certainly, that being in your mouth, it's not a very pleasant discussion, but being in your mouth.
No, but I think it's important.
People are important, yeah. That can rot your teeth a lot. It's obviously very bad. And again, what you're doing is you're not allowing the nutrients from the food to obviously, you know, dissipate in your body, which is what we need to be healthy. I think it can cause a lot of poor sleep, general weakness, fatigue, difficulty in concentrating.
Yeah.
So, you know, you find people with low cognitive functioning, so people struggling to, just complete simple tasks or sleep well. It's all of these things that it can affect. Yeah,
which is quite incredible because I guess if you're obsessed about something, you don't really see the downside. That just comes along with the...
No.
And what's the, what are they trying to achieve?
When they're sort of purging.
Or avoiding food. Is it to gain control on something in life because they feel out of control, or is there a general kind of thing?
I think it's different for different people. I think part of it, particularly with anorexia, I think the disorder gets hold. I think it skew the view that person has of themselves. I think this is the problem with it. I think it often starts, you know, a simple thing we were just talking about, you know, somebody making a comment about, you know, you might need to lose a bit of weight. I think often what can happen is that a young person, you know, is being a bit focused on how they look compared to maybe some of their peers or what they see in the media. And they maybe say to themselves, actually, yeah, maybe I could do with losing a bit of weight. And to start with, it's quite easy.
Mm.
You know, you don't need to restrict too much to start to see some, you know, some difference in your body shape and your weight. Of course, what can happen for some people is that then starts quite quickly to become obsessional. And it becomes a challenge. And I think what happens is some young people, it's like, wow, how far can I go? How long? So, for example, how long can I go before I have something to eat or drink?
That's interesting.
It becomes a real challenge. And almost a self, you know, a competition with the self in a way that you've got to see, push yourself, just how far can I go here? And I think what then happens when parents understandably are concerned are then wanting them to eat more and be more focused on these. They then see that parent is trying to block them in some ways, trying to control them. So they push back even more.
Mm.
And this is the danger.
Mm.
It's how, you know, do I say something or don't I? So I'll often hear parents saying I'm at a loss at whether I should be saying to my child that I you know, they look unwell and I'm concerned about them, because what can happen is I see that it makes them almost more determined to lose weight.
Yeah.
So that can be really hard. And I've seen that on wards. I mean, downside I feel of having a ward with people with anorexia is they become very competitive with each other.
Wow.
And it's shocking, actually. You know, they'll almost be challenging each other about who's the lowest weight on the ward. You know,
in a way, you must be trying to find sort of some self-worth within that.
Yeah.
Competition.
Yeah, because you hate yourself. I mean, that's the real underneath it all. It's that sense. It's that self-hatred. You know, I hate who I am. I think when it's the image that you have of yourself, it makes sense, doesn't it? You want to change just that image. So if you're thinking, you know, I'm not good enough. I don't have enough friends. People don't like me. The obvious thing to do is to change how you look.
Yeah.
And of course, therefore, changing your body shape. That, you know, you're physically, I guess, showing externally that, look, you know, I look different, maybe you'll be more accepting of me. And sadly, of course, that it doesn't have the desired effect.
No, and you know, real friends don't care. They just want you to be happy and healthy.
Yeah, exactly.
Real friends don't care.
Yeah.
It's just what you think other people think of you, right? I was looking at a picture the other day. I was doing this documentary, so I had to go for some old pictures. And I remember thinking, going on a job, like, oh God, you look real mess. And I looked at myself and I was like, wow, you looked amazing. What was I thinking at the time? You know, that self-judgment.
Do you think it's sad, though, as well? That's
incredibly sad.
You can't, that almost it takes you to look back on it to say, actually, I do look great. Yeah.
Not that I was in a fantastic location with great people and this thing, just obsessed about how I looked.
Yeah.
And it's very sad.
Yeah. Because, and this is the bit, it's the small wins. I mean, that's the hardest part, I think.
Yeah.
When you're working with somebody with an eating disorder is to take those small wins and try and acknowledge it. I think because, again, it's an obvious thing. It's tangible, isn't it? You know I'm looking at you and I have a view of how you look. It's very hard, I think, for that person to be okay with people commenting on how they look. They see it as very negative all the time. And it's long. This is the problem with it. That's why it becomes a long-term process. You know, I think for a lot of people, I think once they have that view of themselves, it's very hard to change that long-term.
Yeah.
I think they improve and they can definitely get back to a healthy weight, but there's often that voice inside, you know, just you know, nibbling away at times and just being very negative about them.
What's the is there a most common addiction at the moment you see with young people? I know we spoke before and there's a lot of ketamine around and drugs are cheap.
Yeah.
What seems to be the most prominent habit or drug that people are taking?
I would say ketamine at the moment. That's the that's the one we're seeing. Again, just because it's easy access and it's relatively cheap. That's definitely the one I think, certainly in the service, because it's young people I'm working with currently, and that's by far, I would say, the one that they will say that they've dabbled in, they've started to take.
What's the downside of ketamine?
Well, I can share, we've got somebody at the moment, a young person who's what they call bladder ketamine. You know, it's where the bladder is drastically affected, and she, you know, she's incontinent, which, you know, you can't even imagine, can you, somebody in their, you know, late teens. Like,
that's it now.
Yeah, well, she's on the list to have an operation. We're hoping, I mean, this person's been using ketamine for a number of years and very high levels. But you don't have to use a high amount to have this effect. But they're on the waiting list with the NHS in the hope that they're going to get an operation that should improve that. But, you know, hit her extreme, she can be up 10 times a night. Yes. She's just having that control. And so she's in her late teens. And I get that, you know, that's it. People aren't thinking like that when you're wanting to, you know, explore and try new things and try a drug. Of course, they're not thinking like that, but that's something we would really want to get that message out there, that there's such a, it's a very dangerous drug to be playing with as well.
Because when you're younger, you think you're bulletproof, don't you?
Yeah.
Oh, I can speak for myself. I did, and that won't happen to me. That's for other people on TV and stuff.
Of course, yeah.
So it must be, it's pretty devastating, because there are a lot of people that have bladder problems.
I mean, it really does affect. Yeah, I think that's the, by far probably the thing that we would say, you really do want to be avoiding it for that reason.
What would you advise for young people? Because it is difficult. If all your friends are doing ketamine or smoking, or you got some people that are purging, or how do you... How do they get out of that? How do they kind of remove themselves or change their mind about that? What would be the best thing for them to do?
I think there's several things.
Sorry, that was a big
question. No, it's okay. There's several things, really. I think it's, I think their peer group could be one. I think we will often, you know, say something, you know, looking at the people you're hanging around with, you're talking to, you're chatting with, are they, we call them safe. Would you say they're safe people, are that you mentioned earlier? Are they really true friends? Do you think, is it ended up where you're hanging around with people because they like doing the same drugs that you like doing, and it feels good at the time? So that's one of the first things we'll say. Look, I think you really need to think about who the people you're spending time with, either in person or online. And that's usually, they recognise, there's probably a lot of people around that they're not real friends at all. Mm. I've ended up just being with these people because they also like doing drugs. So that's something we say, look, you can change that straight away. That will make a difference. Definitely we encourage meetings, so NA, AA, depending on what they're, you know, if it's drugs or alcohol or both. We will always say some, you know, it's part and parcel of you know, your journey, you need to try them. It's not for everybody, but we would always say, please go, just try, see what you think. Most people really get something from that as well.
Do they seem to stay as well?
Yeah, I think I would say it's a very small percentage that are turned off by it. Sometimes, you know, I can understand if you're very young, you go to some of the meetings, you have a lot of older people. So, that, you know, the great thing now, especially in London, there's so many meetings at different age groups. You know, you can
find,
it really is good, isn't it? And, you know, you can have, you know, all male or all female, if that's what you'd rather. You can have young groups, you can have mixed. And I think it's about saying, okay, try lots of different ones and see which one you feel works best for you and you get the most from.
Yeah.
And what's great, people approach, you know, people will want to be your sponsor. So people who are going through it themselves will approach you and say, look, you know, I can be your sponsor. I can be somebody when you're struggling, you know, you can contact me and we can talk through it first in the hope that we'll stop you actually taking that drug or, you know, picking up that drink. And in the most occasions that works very well.
I think my experience, before I went to, I remember seeing Meatloaf on Fight Club and thinking I would never go to one of those meetings. And the stuff that I'd heard before just put me off. But when I went, what I experienced was, and I wish I'd done this when I was younger, was a community of people that had experienced desperate situations, but come out, everyone smiling. The people that have done the work are smiling, got a good sense of humour about it.
Yeah.
And you have this comradeship that's beyond, it's tighter than a family. I mean, I'm very close to my parents, but they don't know half the things.
Yeah.
And you can talk to people openly and honestly. Yeah. And there's a sort of, in my experience, like a relief, like I finally feel like I'm fitting in somewhere, you know? And I think the more that someone works their program and does this stuff, the more clarity and ease they have. I mean, to get it when you're young, I think it's really a really good thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, we were talking earlier about shame, and I know that's one that I suppose one of the feelings a lot of young people come with, you know, and especially around their parents, the last thing they want to do is admit to the parents that they're struggling. And also, for most of them, you know, we don't want our parents to know all the details. I wouldn't expect, you know, to tell my kids everything I go through, and vice versa. And I agree that sense you can go somewhere where people get you. They relate, you know, and as you said, they're not judging you. It's really powerful. And I think that's why I would say we would, in any setting, you know, be it, you know, a ward, an inpatient service, or, a rehab service, the meetings for us are something we would really say, please just try, give it a go. Don't
and
make a judgment free
as well,
you.
Aren't they?
Yeah, it's
I mean, you can
it's,
put a pound
so
in the pot.
Everywhere. They're fantastic. Yeah.
Can we touch on shame? We've done so well all the way through now, but shame. Shame's a word I think can be misunderstood. Mm. What is shame, and how does that affect some of these young people?
I think it's a personal judgment in a way of how, I'm trying to think how to define this, of how maybe things they've done or said where they think others will judge them in the way that was a terrible thing to do, or a stupid thing to do. And I think believing that, you know, that others think this is a silly or stupid or terrible thing that I've done, they then feel shameful in a way that, you know, it's, I suppose what they're saying to themselves is, I never should have done that. It's that must, you know, I should never have done that. It was a really, you know, stupid judgment, or I didn't think things through. And I think it's that very unforgiving. So I think it's a sense where, you know, rather than saying, okay, look, that it was a stupid thing actually, and if I'd thought about it or given it a bit more time, I might have made a different decision. What we're trying to do, I guess, is enable young people to be more forgiving of themselves. That, you know, we all make mistakes. We're none of us are perfect. We learn by our mistakes. We, you know, I think we all develop because there are things if we'd done differently, you know, it would have been a different outcome. I think it's also society again. I think there's a pressure, isn't there, to get things right all the time, to be a certain way, to behave a certain way, to say things in a certain way. I think there's that pressure that if we don't conform with all things, it, you know, to an extreme degree, it's shameful.
I think that's so well said, because, I mean, I practice that now. It's just, if I say something, you know, you do learn by your habits. You speak to any CEO, entrepreneur, someone who's in the military, you have to learn. That's how you learn. Yeah. We're taught that it's the opposite way, isn't it?
Totally.
So I think that's really, really important.
Yeah.
Last question, Alex. So if there's someone listening who's young and they don't know where to go or what to do if they have addiction problems or food issues, what would you suggest they do?
So there's so many places, I think, now that you can reach out, you know, to get advice. I mean, I think there's, you know, lots of free services out there, you know, addiction services that you know, you can ring, you can have a confidential discussion with somebody, you know, just to talk through what you're feeling. I mean, you know, there's your local NHS services as well, you know, that you can call your local community service. There are people that will be non-judgmental, will just be willing to listen, and just, you know, hear what it is that you've got to say, and then we'll point you in the right direction. Because what we do know is struggling on your own, frankly, is only going to make the matter worse. Mm. The problem isn't going to go away on its own. We know that by reaching out, by talking even just to one person, that can change your life. And I really believe that. I've seen that happen. Just that first, that ability to ring and make that call or send an email or a text just to say, look, I need help. I think that can really change people's lives.
And I think that's really important what you just said, because there is hope, right?
Yeah,
all and the you time. Can be... Yeah. Have really bad food issues or drug addiction, but it can change.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's a really important thing is that I used to have really bad obsessive thoughts about things, and now it's not there.
Yeah.
And I don't have cravings anymore at the moment, because I work a program. Yeah. I think that's important to put in.
Definitely.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation, which educates children about addiction through school talks and provides some basic support for those struggling with addiction. To find out more what we do, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. You can also donate. Please donate. It will help us to break the stigma of addiction. It will help us to educate more young people, and it will allow us to bring you more episodes. Thank you. See you next time.